It's a Forensic Friday. We are going to wrap up a case we started last week. Maybe one of the, if not the most compelling stories I have ever heard. The victim in this case, Sharon Muse, was with us last week and will be back with us again this morning to tell her story. It involved her being abducted, kidnapped, assaulted by a former client. She's an attorney. It's a shocking and amazing story. And we only got through the crime last week. We didn't get to the trial. So she'll be back with us this week. And along with her will be Mary Houlihan, victim's right advocate from the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. You don't want to miss this. I'm telling you, it's really interesting. Hours. Well, this is a Forensic Friday. And we have a guest who is back with us for the second week because we really didn't get finished last week. Her story is so compelling and horrific at the same time. The month of April, now we're into May, but the month of April was National Crime Victim Rights, or actually the last week in April, the 19th through the 25th, was National Crime Victims Week. And Ray is off today, but Mary Houlihan is with us, and Mary's just a regular on this program here many, many times because she is a victim's rights advocate in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. Mary, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
You're just one of my favorite people. You know that.
I hope you know it's reciprocal.
Well, good. And we have with us this morning for the second week, Sharon Muse. Sharon, good morning, and thank you so much for coming back.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back.
Put you through this again.
That's all right.
Well, the whole point was you were victimized by a criminal, and then you were re-victimized by our court system.
Absolutely.
And you're an attorney.
Yes, sir.
And had you not been an attorney, there's no telling how more you would have been re-victimized.
Right.
So here's what we're going to do. We know that there are people, Mary, who are tuning in that didn't hear our program last week.
That's right.
So I thought the most appropriate thing to do is to have Sharon tell her story and give her enough time to do that. If you can do it in 8 or 9 minutes.
Okay.
Up to when you were kind of taken away from that nightmare that you were in. Well, then we will take a break, and then we will get to the part we missed last week, and that is what happened between 2006 and 2011, which is a ridiculous amount of time.
I agree.
All right, so Sharon Muse, tell us your story.
In 2006, April 7th, 2006, I was leaving my law office at 5 o'clock. When I opened the door, I saw a man's sleeve disappear, jerked back as if he was hiding from me. And when I went around the corner, I discovered a man who immediately started speaking to me like a client. He was very familiar with me. He was telling me I'd represented him in the past. He was very upset, frightened, claimed that his wife had just died. The family was scared. The grandmother loved me. They needed my help. I was this great lawyer, and only I could help him.
Do you remember him?
I'm terrible with clients. If there's any clients listening, I apologize. But I'm terrible about remembering facts. I can remember a face, but never a name. So his face felt familiar to me, and his comfort level with me let me know that I had interacted with him previously.
Okay.
So he's, you know, and honestly, I was thinking it must have been an adoption case because he kept talking about his grandmother and his family, and I thought, well, I must have done something nice for this family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excusing his erratic behavior. He's physically crossing boundaries, too close to me, blocking my way a little bit. I'm trying to walk down the hallway to get to my car, and it's this strange, I move this way, he moves that way. I think I've referred to it before as like a game of chess.
And you said you felt threatened from just about the get-go last week, right?
When I opened the door and I saw his sleeve jerk back, my instincts were saying to me, that's odd. If this was a client, why is he not in one of my two waiting rooms? Clients don't lurk around the hallway waiting
right.
for you. So, I mean, as I said last week, it was 62 seconds from me opening the door of the office to leave until he opened the door of my car and got in it without my permission.
How do you know that?
I went back and redid it, and I went through my notes, and I had somebody before the trial, because I assumed I would be asked a lot of questions about that particular phase of it. So we walked through that, and in that time period, now I could be off by a couple of seconds, But in that short window of time, my instincts noticed 14 different signals that he was showing me. He had bad intentions for me. And I didn't see them because I don't think that way. I don't think like a predator. You know, I've been raised to do unto others, trust best intentions, all the good church things you learn, all the good Southern hospitality. And then you are sworn to zealously represent your clients. So all this combines for me to think, you know, this man is grieving. He's frightened. I can't just brush him off. That's rude. It's hateful. You know, just I was telling myself, okay, just take a few seconds, try to calm him down and get him something he needs. So
and he wanted a ride. Is that what the...
Not yet? No. He wanted me to help him because his wife had just died. And all their accounts were frozen, so he said. His wife had died like 5 years earlier. And obviously, I did not know he had a knife strapped to his ankle at this point. So he's telling me, we need your help, we need your help, we're afraid. And I told him, I said, the courts are closed, I can't do anything for you. Go back, make an appointment with my secretary, Judy, and we'll be glad to help you first thing Monday morning. Well, I couldn't shake him, which was another big clue. So I'm continuing and being polite, and I'm asking him questions. Okay, well, were there two witnesses on the will? Were those witnesses notarized? Are you the executor? And he was articulate, and he answered these questions in a way that led me to believe that this was true, that he really had just read this will, and he was frightened.
Were you staying in the hall? Were you on the way to the car?
I was moving. I was trying to move the entire time.
To get to your car, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. So when I got close to my car, I said again, okay, it sounds like the will's a valid will. Go back up and talk to Judy, and I'll see you first thing Monday morning. So I turned my back to him, put everything away. I'm getting in my car door, and I see him getting in the other side of my car door.
Whoa.
Right? And I said, I just froze. And he right then, this big thundercloud came up and rumbling and little bits of rain came. And he said, I walked here. Can you give me a ride to my grandma's house? And I said, well, can't you walk back? And it was what I thought was I was trying to let him down nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But in truth, he was auditioning me to see what kind of a victim I was going to be. And I was at what I call a very soft target. I was asking him permission to not get in my car instead of telling him to get away from me.
Don't get in my car, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which now, clearly, I'd have no problem.
Sure.
But then I was just so confused. I'm like, okay, here's this client. He's grieving. And I think, okay, he's just, this grief is making him irrational. He's not thinking clearly. And I said, oh, I've got to be in Louisville in an hour. I gave him 7 excuses instead of just sticking my hand up in the air and saying, you need to step away from my car. You're making me uncomfortable. Now, if I had, that may have delayed him. He might have walked away, but he would have come back for me. He hunted me.
Yeah.
He waited for me. There were witnesses that saw him waiting for me the entire afternoon in the back lobby, the back parking lot of our office. He had called my office several times throughout the day, acting like he wanted an appointment. And finally, my secretary had said, she has to leave right at 5. She can't see you today. She's booked. So he was waiting.
You were being stalked.
Me. Yes.
Yeah.
And he had a plan, and so I might have deterred it a little bit, but he would have come back.
Okay, we're going to fast forward to, just for time purposes, mm-hmm. He got in your car, you
yes.
were driving around, you had your boyfriend on the phone.
Yes, I called him and hoping he would listen.
Mm-hmm.
He's a smart guy, pays attention, was taking notes the whole time.
This was in Scott County.
Yes,
he ended
sir.
Up taking you... With
Bourbon
you driving
County.
To Bourbon County to a farm that was obviously nobody lived there.
Right.
What happened at that point?
When we got up to the farm, you know, this has been 42, 45 minutes of being inside the car with him hitting me or grabbing me sexually or putting his hand between my legs or sticking his fist in my face and telling me not to disrespect him. You know, people always say, why didn't you just stop your car? And I was like, well, I couldn't. His hands were on me the whole time. So we get up there, and inside of my brain, I'm thinking, okay, you know, you've got to walk away from this. You've got to walk away from this. Then I'm starting to think, okay, he's going to rape you. He's going to rape you. What are you going to do about this? And when we pulled up and I saw the place where he told me to pull over, I knew with certainty he was going to kill me. It wasn't an if. It was like, you're dying. This is it. And I did something unusual. I reversed the car back into the parking, into the driveway, so I could drive off really quickly, and I start screaming for him to get out of the car, get out of the car, get out of the car.
And he pulled the knife on you yet?
Not at this point. We're getting close.
Yeah.
And so he grabs me, and we'd been fighting a little bit, but at this point, it's full blows to the face, crashing my head in the window, smacking me into the steering wheel, grabs me by the, rips my bra and my shirt off and slams me down into the console. And as he's doing that, I see his right hand going down, it's like in slow motion, and pulling his pant leg up and pulling this black object that had been strapped to his ankle. And I just assumed it was a gun. So I'm screaming, he's got a gun, he's got a gun, call the police. But I'm watching him bring this knife up, and he's shoving this knife into my throat, but I don't feel a cut. I don't feel blood. I just feel this pressure. Well, the knife had gotten jammed in this big chunky necklace that I was wearing, so it wasn't actually cutting my throat. It was just shoving this part of my necklace into my throat. And the next thing I know is he's off me. The knife is out of his hand. It's broken. My dashboard's scarred up. He's looking around like, what just happened? I'm thinking, okay, here's your shot. So we really start fighting. I'm trying to jerk the keys out of the car because I think, you know, if I'm knowing I'm going to die, I don't think for a minute I'm going to live through it. I think they just need to find your body. So I'm trying to get the car keys out and throw them out into a field. And as I'm trying to do that, I glanced away from him and I saw a truck driving down the road. So now I'm thinking, you get in front of that truck, you live through this. So after several attempts, I get out of the car after he's trying to pull me back in. I dash out into the street with blood on my breast and hair hanging out, and I'm screaming and scared this man to death, not thinking he's going to stop, but thinking I have to stand still because it's either get hit by a truck or stabbed to death by this guy. So he stopped, another truck stopped with a husband and wife, and those people stayed there and kept him from me until the police got there. And this whole time, he kept trying to get to me while I was on the phone with 911. And the witness testimony was that they had to get a big pipe out of their truck and hold it, and they were talking to this man, and he eventually admitted, yes, he had a knife, and he laid it down. And
tell us about the couple that you think saved your life.
Oh, I know they did. I get a little bit choked
okay.
up when I think
okay.
about them.
Yeah.
It was a husband and wife, and they had driven by, and they had seen him beating me, and their testimony was that they could see my face was purple, that I was screaming. They didn't know if it was a domestic violence situation. They had no idea what it was, but they knew he was hurting me, so they stopped to help, and they put themselves in harm's way.
Right.
So they didn't know if he had a gun, so they get out. The wife comes back, and she's trying to keep me calm, and her testimony was that I was, you know, kind of going back and forth between being hysterical and being somewhat making sense, and that I was swaying and having a hard time breathing. She was afraid I was going to pass out, that, you know, I'm yelling at him to stay away from me because he's trying to get to me. So the two men are physically blocking him from getting to me. And, you know, he's yelling stuff over my head like, you know, Sharon, why are you making this up? Why are you doing this? We're just out here doing cocaine together. She's tripping. She's making this up. You know, she's wanting to be with me, and she's just upset, which they're not buying any of that. And they stood there while I was on the phone with 911. And, in fact, they had to tell them where we were because I had no idea. I had no idea what county I was in.
Yeah.
Because we didn't drive a direct route. He took me on a very long path with lots of twists and turns down country roads, and I was totally disoriented and trying to watch his hands and keep his hands off me and trying to drive and trying to pay attention to where I was, because I would say things to Jeff, who was listening on the phone, like, why are we turning by this lumber yard?
Yeah.
Is this the airport? Are we in Bourbon County? So that he could give the police directions to find me.
All right, there's the crime, folks, and we're going to come back and have some more of that. But when I come back, I'm going to turn it over to you, Mary, and we'll talk about how this person was not just victimized once, but was victimized not only by this perpetrator, but also by the court system. We'll take a break and be right back.
To get the records from the state trooper that was the officer in my case, because there were a lot of things that didn't make sense to me, like certain questions I was asked on the stand. I didn't know why I was being asked those questions. And the thing is, as a victim, I'm not allowed to sit in the courtroom. I'm just a witness like anybody else. I have no say, no voice. They call me in, I say my bit, and I leave.
Oh, gee.
Now, the defendant gets to be there start to finish. He gets to call witnesses. He gets to hear everybody's testimony, and then he chooses whether or not he testifies. For me, they don't want me to hear anyone else's testimony. They say it could taint mine. There's no logic there. Obviously, it could taint the defendants as well. But for me, I'm sitting in a room by myself wondering what's being told to these group of 12 strangers that are going to decide my entire future. When I am the one person in this whole room that knows this case best, I'm the one that's excluded. I can't take notes to hand to the prosecutor to say, hey, you forgot to mention this. Hey, what about this piece of evidence? Hey, I don't think the jury got that. Any victim can do that. You don't have to be a lawyer to do that, because every single victim knows their case far better than any investigator or prosecutor. But they are the one person that's excluded from the courtroom.
So what happened when you...
Well, I'm trying to temper my response, because I thought, this is unfortunate that I'm reading it 2 days before I go back, because I'm pretty hot about it. I'm livid, actually. In reading through that report, I discovered that the reason I didn't have evidence at my second trial, because I don't know that we've gotten there yet, but when the first trial was scheduled, this man stood up and pled guilty to everything. Everything. So 2 weeks later, he files a motion to withdraw his guilty plea, and we go into 6 to 8 months of multiple hearings and why he couldn't and whether or not he understood what he was doing, and, you know, motion and hearing after hearing for his benefit, which is how the system works. But what I saw in there was that the crime lab was given an order, not from the judge, but was given an order to destroy all the evidence, which is a...
What?
Right.
I can't even answer that. Don't
Yeah, I've got it. They were sent an order to destroy the evidence in my case while my case was in appeal. So there was no knife to show the jury. There was a necklace, because thankfully it worked out for me that they never collected part of the evidence before the first trial, so I still had it. So that worked to my benefit. But
Okay. We'll take a break. This
okay.
might be a good time to take a break. 253-5959. And we're back. Mary Houlihan with the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, victim rights advocate. Sharon Muse, an attorney in Georgetown, our victim in this case. And Mary, take it.
Okay. Well, so when we left off, you had talked about the people that intervened to save your life, and then a law enforcement response did quickly follow. One of the things that has stuck out for me in you telling me about your story is that here you are as victim, but what you can't separate yourself from is all you know about the law. So you're sitting there on basically a gurney in the where the ambulance has responded, and you're seeing the scene not be treated as you knew it should be. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Well, that's when my fear began. You know, I thought once the first responders arrived, I would be safe. I could take a deep breath and things were going to be okay and the nightmare was over. But actually, that's when my second nightmare began. And I'm standing there knowing that I barely escaped this man killing me. I could still, my throat still hurt from him shoving that knife in my throat. And I'm watching evidence be destroyed, trampled, not gathered, not photographed. And I'm completely panicked. Shouting at these first responders and saying, you know, why are you, I can't move my car. You need to photograph this. And so I'm trying to take photographs. One of the first responders had dismissed the witnesses. He was like, thank you. You know, you all can leave. We've got
Did they get their names? No.
I said, you can't let them leave until you get their names and addresses, right? Because you know that. You don't have to be a lawyer to know that. You just watch Law and Order and you know that. So, and let me just say that every single time these first responders leave home, I know that they know they're putting themselves in harm's way. And I thank God for that, and I highly esteem that. And they, that day, stood between me and imminent danger. But it's frustrating to me when very simple mistakes are made that can potentially destroy a case and cause someone like me to have to live the rest of my life looking over my shoulder, waiting to be stabbed to death because basic things aren't being done. So, yes, I said, don't let them leave. You got to get their names and addresses. Why are we not doing this? Why are we not doing that? And I kept, you know, the EMTs kept trying to calm me down, trying to get me to breathe. So even once I got to the hospital, the trooper showed up and casually mentioned to me that one of the stories that was being discussed in the defendant's interrogation was that we were out there together doing cocaine together. Now, I'm a, you know, good little church girl. I don't even take aspirin. I mean, nothing. So, I mean, this just infuriated me. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to do a drug test. And he said, no, you don't need to do that. And I'm, again...
You're saying, give me a drug
mouth
test,
hanging
right?
open. So I hobble out of the bed, go to the doctor's station, and I'm banging with my limp right arm, yelling very loudly, I want a drug test, I want hair, blood, urine, full screen, anything you can do. So the doctor comes in, he did some drug tests, and of course there's nothing at all in my system. And that was my best piece of evidence at the trial. Because, you know, the jury, I'm asking them to put this guy away for life. I've got to give them every bit of rock solid. She is telling us the truth. She is not wavering. She is not confused because of trauma, but she knows what happens. So this was my opportunity. And again, I was discouraged by law enforcement from doing this. This baffles me.
It's baffling, but I'll tell you, there is, for instance, in a SANE exam, a sexual assault exam that occurs after a sexual assault, it's a complicated thing to look at. A normal course of action is not to blood test or drug test the victim, because you're implying that their state of mind has played into their victimization. But what Sharon did is huge, because I've lived through the rape trials where the defense comes out and basically calls the victim themselves every kind of drug user, every kind, and
tramp.
We can't prove otherwise.
Right. Yeah.
Now, or they ask you how you were dressed, which I should be able to walk around buck naked,
exactly.
and nobody gets to rape me.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
End of story.
Exactly right. So, I'm sorry, you keep telling.
So, I get the drug test, and obviously I knew that was going to be clean, and I'm thinking, you know, sweet. I'm trying to build my case from my hospital bed, because I watched it get trampled on the scene. So, the next day, I had a friend of mine who had a really nice professional camera come over and take pictures of the dashboard in my car. Because I wanted the jury to see the level of violence. This was not me slapping him away with my hands. This was me taking everything I had with my fist and pounding him in the face, and him grabbing me by the hair and smashing my head into the dashboard and into the steering wheel and up against the glass. And there was a big gouge in the dashboard that was a perfect arc, and it went over my CD player, popped the buttons off, broke it. And that, to me, was important for them to see that there was so much violence that steel blade on the knife was broken off in this fight. Because, to me, that goes to show what was his intent there. He didn't just kidnap me. That's all he was convicted of. He was there to kill me.
Kill you.
And he was there to rape me. He wasn't charged with those things, attempted murder or attempted rape. But I obviously thought he should have been.
What about the black bag?
Okay, the bag. This bag has haunted me and still does. Now, when I went back and reread all the victim's testimony, apparently it was a dark green bag. But this is interesting. I'm so glad you asked. The victims that were interviewed that day and did a written statement within just a couple of days all put in their statement that they saw this bag. You know, they saw him take it out of my car and walk away with it. And when they were leaving the scene, they saw it in the ditch. And they pointed it out to different officers. So I go back and I read the trooper's statement from his file. And he notes, saw this green bag, don't know what happened to it, didn't pick it up. He's asked about this on the witness stand. Did you see this bag? Yes. Did you pick it up? Nope.
Why not?
That was my question, and that's what I screamed about for all 5 years. Somebody go find that flipping bag.
How did you know the contents of the bag? Because you didn't know.
Because, well, I could see the impression of things inside it as he grabbed it.
And there was a hammer?
It appeared to be a hammer and what looked like a big fat roll of duct tape and some rope. And he grabs it and is walking away. And, you know, my argument is take 30 seconds, pick the bag up, put it in evidence, and then let me have the ability to charge him with additional crimes so that when it does come for the parole board to review, they're going to see, okay, this man didn't just kidnap her. He had all these things lined up. He was only 6 days out of prison. No, we don't need to let him out again. Because in 2026, I have to do the same song and dance again in front of the parole board and beg that group of strangers to not put him on the street, because it doesn't matter that it's 2026. He's going to try to kill me. I shouldn't have to live like that.
We're taking a break. We'll be right back. This is week two that could lead on to week three, to week four, to week five, because there's so much to talk about here. But Mary, you take it.
Okay. So again, knowing that you were able to do things and fight this fight for your rights as victim differently than so many of our victims out there feel like they have the strength or wherewithal to do, tell a little bit. Some of the other points that really hit me were during the trial, I believe you told me a little bit about a confession letter that you had to make into an exhibit in order for it to be used.
Yes, the first trial was scheduled to start on a Wednesday, and the Friday before, I was called into the prosecutor's office to discuss. The defendant had offered he would serve 5 years, and I said no. Life is, I would accept life, but nothing less than that. So in the course of that meeting, I was shown a letter that the defendant had written his attorney, and thankfully, in his effort to be clever, he had his cellmate sign it. So when you that waived privilege. Typically, that letter would have been privileged between he and his attorney, but because he had a third party sign it, that was no longer a privileged piece of information, so anybody could read it. So his cellmate sends it over to the prosecutor's office. Prosecutor shows me. I'm like, great. This is basically a confession of the he confessed to pulling the knife out, that he wouldn't get out of the car, that he told me where to go. I've got kidnapping locked down, and then, you know, we can talk about what all we can do with this confession about the knife. So there was some pushback that no, we couldn't in fact use this letter, and so I did a brief memorandum of the rules of evidence and how this would be allowed to be used as a piece of evidence, and then I took a copy and I went to Kinko's and I blew it up and I put it on a big foam core board and I made handouts for the jury and I brought it back on Monday and left it at the prosecutor's office and said I expect to see this in the trial, period. This is going to be evidence. You know, I'm not playing around. So I did that. I listened to the taped interviews of various cellmates that he had had in his stay in the jail. And I made notes about what they had said, what things were true, what things were false, what was twisted up. I listened to his interview. They gave me that so that I could walk through that and make questions for him in case he did decide to testify. I purposely avoided Jeff Ballard, who was what I thought was one of my strongest witnesses. I didn't ever speak to him about the case. You know, we had been dating.
That was your boyfriend at
yes,
the time.
Yes, sir. Yeah, we had been dating. We stopped dating, and I told him, I said, look, I don't want to have any contact with you, not for any personal reasons, but to protect your testimony at the trial. He did an amazing job. Every single time the defense came at him to twist his words, he was able to take it back and make it to my benefit. So I will tell you this. The system did not protect me. I protected myself. And you cannot sit back and expect a flawed system filled with people that work very hard but still make mistakes to protect you. You got to get in it. You got to work it. You got to pay attention and make yourself be heard and take advantage of what tiny little threads. There are little tiny windows of opportunity for a victim to be heard. You need to be heard.
Why did this thing take from 06 to 11 to be resolved in 30 seconds?
Because the system allows the defendant to have a long list of rights. He has a right to have this evaluation or that evaluation. If he changes his mind on his plea, he gets to withdraw that. Then we have 8 months of hearings over whether or not he should have withdrawn that plea. Thankfully, Judge Johnson was an amazing judge. He was always knew everything that was going on when we walked into the courtroom. I went to every single status hearing. Every time this was in the courtroom, I was in the courtroom because I wanted him to know that this was life or death to me. And he treated me in this case and the defendant with respect.
Now, how did it end up? What happened in 2011?
We finally had a trial. I talked to the jury and laid it on them and said, you have the power to give me my life back or not, and I'm begging you to do that. Because I want the opportunity to die like you do. Like, I want to die of old age or maybe a disease or even a car wreck. But I don't want to die with someone stabbing me to death repeatedly.
What was he sentenced to?
Life in prison. He's up for parole in 2026. Life doesn't mean life.
Oh, we learn that every week here.
Every week.
Every week. So we got 30 seconds.
So do please check out Sharon's website, ownyourmoment.org. It's going to teach you a lot about how to fight for your rights as victim, even though officially in Kentucky victims don't have rights. But she will teach you a lot about working around the system and making your case strong.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Stand by. We got an update.